tonight on Arena. We get a bird's eye view of the recording of U2's first album, Boy, and Claudia Boyle introduces us to La Bellissima, Anna Mofo. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Well, today marks the 40th anniversary of the release of U2's first album, Boy. To mark this auspicious date, last week Sean Rock spoke to producer Steve Lillywhite.
On October the 20th, 1980, the debut album from a then little-known Dublin band called U2 was released. Recorded at Windmill Lane Studios in Dublin, it was the band's first time working with producer Steve Lillywhite, who had a few unorthodox production methods, such as recording Larry Mullen Jr. drumming in a stairwell. Since that debut album 40 years ago, obviously you remember it, Steve, U2 have gone on conquer the globe, reinvent the nature of the stadium concert and establish themselves as iconic figures far beyond just their music. We'll speak to Steve more about stairwells and drums and other aspects in a minute. But let's find out how it all began. The opening track on the album, I Will Follow.
That still sounds fantastic, that track, doesn't it? Wow, what a great live feel that we got on those recordings. I'm very proud of the album, mainly because it was the first ever rock album to be successfully recorded in Ireland. Because all up until that time, all the Irish bands had come over to London to make their records, like Thin Lizzy and the Boomtown Rats. Mm. They all moved to London to record, whereas U2 said that they wanted to record their first album in Dublin. So, you know, when I came to Windmill Lane, I looked around and I have to say, it was not made for recording rock music because the actual studio was absolutely dead. There was nothing lively, nothing exciting about the sound. But every morning when I walked into the studio, I walked through the reception of Windmill Lane, and it was this wonderful sort of stone reception room. So I went to the studio manager and I said, we want to record the drums here. And he looked at me and thought I was smoking crack. And he said, but that's where the receptionist sits. And I say, well, what time does the receptionist go home? And he said, well, she goes home at 6 o'clock. I said, all right, then, well, can we do the drums at 6 o'clock? And he couldn't think of another reason why not. At which point, Larry Mullen's dad came into the situation because Larry was only 17 and he had to be home for his tea. So it was all a little bit crazy. But we did set up the drums out at night. By the reception, because a lot of people listening now don't understand this, but back in those days there were no cell phones or anything, so the only way that you could communicate with anyone in the studio or the whole rest of Windmill Lane was through this receptionist, you know, and she would then transfer the calls to the various different places.
Two very important questions jump up at me the minute I hear that. First of all, did Larry go home and get his tea and come back in every night?
No. But his dad came to collect him after he'd finished his drumming because, you know, well, what are you doing working at night? People don't work at night.
They do their homework. Well, I suppose he may have been
finished. Literally do their homework at night. Yeah. This is what I love, though. When you listen to this album, you can really hear great bass parts, great guitar parts, and great drum parts, and Bono. I mean, but maybe the singing isn't as good as actually the music. Bono became a great singer, obviously, but I think he was still looking for his voice on the first. I mean, it's very good singing, but you know, it's great guitar playing.
Yeah.
I mean, Edge has always been top of the line.
It really does jump out of it. Just let me get my second question in about the reception area. Did the phone ring?
Okay.
Did the phone ring at night?
Well, sometimes it did, but you know, it was so cacophonous, the sound of Larry's drums, that it didn't matter. I mean, always think, you know, if you get the phone ringing during a take, it's like a blessing. It's so cool that if anyone ever hears it, they don't think it's a mistake. They just think, you know, that it was meant to be.
I hear the sound of people picking up their vinyls and going to, I'm going to listen till I hear a phone ringing on this,
well,
on this
no,
album.
No, but you listen to I Will Follow, and well, we've just listened to it, but the middle section where he sings, your eyes make a circle, I see you when I come in there. There's Bono, me breaking bottles out in the room. It's crazy.
Why were you breaking bottles?
Well, we were breaking bottles, and then I had a bicycle turned on its saddle upside down. I was spinning the wheel with the pedal and running a knife through the spokes. So it went brrrrup, which, you know, if you know it's there now, you can listen to it at the end of the track. But yeah, the bottles breaking is something that's quite a well-known fact.
40 years ago, Steve, and you're speaking to me as if you recorded this album last week.
Well, you know, you do remember certain things, and maybe I told these stories 20 years ago as well, and then but who knows? No, it is weird how certain things you do remember. I mean, you know, what did I do yesterday? I've got no idea. But 40, yes, I remember doing that on Boy, and I remember us not having a synthesizer, so Edge played he played the guitar tuner by changing the tone of the guitar tuner to the different notes on Into the Heart.
Wow, it would seem that even at that stage in the very early days, that aspect of U2's sound, the guitar playing from the Edge, was there from the outset.
It really was. You know, he had his little echo box, and well, Edge has always been the master. He's always been the scientist of the band. No question about it.
That's what it is. Let's listen to Stories for Boys, actually, because I want to ask you about something that strikes me or has struck me several times when I listen to this track and the guitar in it. Stories for Boys from the debut U2 album Boy, and speaking with me this evening, remembering 40 years back with great ease, it has to be said, producer Steve Lillywhite. Now, my question about Stories for Boys, it kind of strikes me, and as I listen to it, it's almost as if the guitar there is, it's like it's asking a little question all the time. That kind of motif.
Yeah. It's one of those classic Edge riffs, isn't it? This is what makes Edge such a brilliant guitar player, is that he has guitar part. He doesn't play chords. A lot of guitarists would just play chords and not play a riff. But what he does, he sort of plays a riff around the chords. And that's his unique style. That's why the guitar is always a hook. You know, and that's something that you two have always been so that, you know, every song has to have a hook, not just the melody, not just the singing, but the music has to have a real hook to it. And that, of course, is what Edge's. I mean, it becomes more and more difficult the older you get, because, you know, how many hooks are there left to be written? one could argue.
To what extent, you know, we've been speaking a lot about the Edge. You've said that while Bono's voice may not have been there then, it certainly came into its own later on.
Oh.
So they knew their strengths. What did they know of their limitations at that time? And how did they address those limitations?
Well, they were humble, and they were never part of the scene. You know, they looked at London and New York as well, as the sort of place where, you know, in London it was the Clash and the Sex Pistols. In New York it was the Ramones and the Talking Heads. For them, you know, these were the huge bands, and you know, so they were humble. That was definitely, I mean, but that's a strength as well, isn't it? Staying humble, limitation. You know, to be honest, in those days there was no sign of McFisto. You know, I mean, Bono was not his dad, because Bono basically turned into his father, which is fantastic. You know, he's a good laugh and he's fantastic now. But this is one thing that I have realized, is that most rock stars, when they've got nothing, they're free and easy and they're happy. When they've got lots of money, they become paranoid and live in their in their big castle. But with U2, it's been the opposite. You know, they were very, not paranoid in those early days, but they were very, very serious. But once success came later down the road, a few albums later, you know, they started to loosen up and they started to realize that, you know, life is to be enjoyed more and more.
They started to have fun, I guess. But I'm always wondering as well, Steve, you know, you let's face it, the people that you were working with since, and certainly in 1980, Peter Gabriel, I think, was his solo album came out in that year. XTC, Black Sea came out in 1980. And it was a big year for other bands as well. AC/DC, Back in Black, etc., etc. But you probably could have, you were near a point where you could have chosen who you wanted to work with. Why did you want to work with U2? What made you want to work with them at that time?
I've always been lucky enough to be able to work with who I've wanted to, because I've always had more work offered to me than what I can do. And I don't see it as work. I see it as a vocation. So for me, I can't sort of just dial it in. I want to work with great people, you know, And I wasn't convinced when I heard the first recordings of U2. So I said, take me to a gig. So I went to this gig on the west coast of Ireland, and I was picked up at the airport by I was told a Mr. McGuinness would meet me. Now, this was 1979. With a name like McGuinness in Ireland, I was convinced he would be on a tractor with straw in his hair, you know. But in fact, you know, we turned up and I turned up at the airport, and there was Mr. McGuinness. He says, "Hello, Steve. How are you?" You know, an absolute gentleman, an absolutely wonderful, wonderful man who became a very close friend for up until now, you know. So I went to the gig, and it was in a little school hall with all the boys on one side and the girls on the other, you know, and they came out and they played I Will Follow. And it was fantastic. Now, I'd heard some recordings beforehand, and they didn't show anything of what this band could do, but live there was something about them, just the way that they almost otherworldly. That's the thing. I mean, Bono is probably the most cack-handed person you will ever meet. You know, he's famous for being a bad driver and all that, but the moment Bono gets on a stage, he's like a ballet dancer. You know, he just, this grace just comes through him. You know, it's like he becomes like a gazelle or something like that. And then when he comes up stage, he turns back into an old cart horse or something like that. No, I don't mean it like that. But
But they've maintained that. I mean, the whole idea of the stadium concert, they brought that, consistently have brought that to a whole new level every time, and different all the time, from album to album, from concert to concert, from stadium performance to stadium performance. That lack of complacency, was that there from the very beginning? You mentioned being humbled. Was this desire, this ambition, I suppose, in some ways, was that there from the very start?
It was right there from the very beginning, because, you know, I'd certainly grown up with the Beatles, and the idea that, you know, the Beatles had different songs on a different style, even though the Beatles only lasted 5 years. If you sort of compare Love Me Do to I Am the Walrus, a huge transition. And with U2, you know, we wanted every record to be something different. And you know, Bono's always talked about the famous quote of chopping down the Joshua tree, you know, for Achtung Baby. And they very much wanted to take their audience on a journey with them. But one great thing I must say about Boy, even though they've done all these different concerts and all that, when they come on and they play any song from Boy, whatever the concert stage, whether it's in an arena or it still sounds fantastic. You know, the moment you hear Edge's guitar going, you know, the whole place goes crazy. Last time they played that on the Joshua Tree tour, that was like, you know, 38 years, 2 years ago. So, you know, it does show that great tunes will last. And they had, you know, these were great tunes in those days.
So I suppose the big work from you came in the first three albums, you know, up to and the breakthrough with War, the third album. How did the role change then, your role with them? Because you're still, you know, you're obviously still pals, you still work together, but your role as a producer, I think, has changed fundamentally as well in what you do with the band.
Yeah, well, what happened was Joshua Tree was taking a little bit of extra time. And it was Paul McGuinness again, wonderful man, who basically sat down with the band and said, look, when you work with Steve, you made records a lot quicker. Now you're working with Brian Eno and Danny Lanois. You know, it's taking a bit longer. What if you bring Steve in? Maybe he can help unlock something to help finish the record. So the band went, OK, let's do that. So I came in and on the Joshua Tree, and basically it was a bit like a relay race. Mm. It's like Brian Eno and Danny Lanois had run the first three laps, had the first three legs, and they just passed me the baton. And my job was to, you know, was to put the extra energy and bring it home. And so my job changed, which was great because, you know, I think they'd been working over a year on the Joshua Tree before I came in. So, and I think it was a little bit that thing of like, I'm 5 years older than Adam, the oldest guy in the band. You know, 5 years when you're 18 and I was 23, that is no. I think Adam was 20 on the first album. I was 25. But even the difference between a 20-year-old and a 25-year-old is very big. So they saw me as being teacher, you know. So they still, when they see me in the studio again, I think it's a little bit like, oh, Steve's here. We better get down to work now. We better behave ourselves.
But you know what? What also strikes me there, Steve, when you talk about people like Lanois, Brian Eno, and Lanois handing over the baton to you. Yeah. And the way that the guys in the band still have a kind of a deference towards you, if that's not too strong a word, it marks a kind of a lack of ego, which we may not always talk about, but an ability to say, look, this isn't about me and what I want and what I think. This is about the music. Let's put ourselves to the one side, put the egos out of the way. Is that how it still happens?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, it's all about the music, you know, and the music is the thing that leads all of them. Throughout their career, Bono wants to be able to play new songs on stage. And to play new songs on stage, he has to drop hits, you know. So he's got to make sure that the audience know those new songs. Yeah, I mean, sometimes they haven't done as well as on other times, but they always come back with something really, really special. So, you know, I'm very proud of them. They're the good guys, you know.
I'm torn between Out of Control and A Day Without Me. I'll let you choose, Steve, how we finish up our chat this evening.
Oh, let's finish with Out of Control.
Why? Why do you choose Out of Control?
It's just, you see, I'd recorded A Day Without Me with the drums not in the stairwell. And I didn't, because I did one single first and then came back to do the album. And I didn't like the way A Day Without Me really sounded. So the drums on A Day Without Me are done in the studio, but the drums on Out of Control were done in the stairwell. So for all you train spotters out there, you can now listen to those two tracks and go, oh, yes, yeah. The drums are a lot more clattery on Out of Control. And it's a, you know, down. Oh, it's great. I love that song.
Steve Lillywhite talking to Sean on the 40th anniversary of U2's Boy.